gang. Welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It's that unexpected gift from heaven, free speech. It's like if you're walking around in the snow when you're a kid and your socks start slipping into your shoe, and it's going to be really uncomfortable, and you're thinking, am I going to have to walk the whole way in the snow with my sock down slipped into my shoe? And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a brand new sock just appears. Maybe it just comes down your pant legs right in the middle, and you can sit down and you can change your sock right there. You weren't expecting that, but it can happen. It really can happen. And that's what RBN is like. So go to republicbroadcasting.org, click on the donate button, send badly needed funds to 2251 Double Creek Drive, Suite 302, Round Rock, Texas, 78664. Phone it into 1-800-724-2719. The operator standing by. We've got with us Mark Collett. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hello, Patrick. It's good to be here today. And I thought I'd start the show with, before we get into the main topic, just a quick shout out for my latest video. It's about a situation we've got in the UK. So, interestingly, you and I have talked about Trump and Trump's let's send them all back kind of rhetoric. And when it sort of panned out, it wasn't really about sending them all back at all. In fact, he doesn't really want to send them all back. He's only doing this, really. It's more tokenism is what I'd call it. I'd say it's more sort of a tokenistic thing. You know, he doesn't have any real desire to get rid of them all. But sending, you know, 200 and some odd back in a day seems like a good thing at first until you realize how many are here. And I've done a video because Labour are doing the same thing here in the UK, which would seem odd because Labour are sort of the social democratic sort of left-wing, left-of-centre party. But they are really, really trying to hammer home to the public that they're sending a lot of people back. And they're claiming that between the date of their election on July the 5th and January the 31st of this year, they've repatriated, remigrated, deported, whatever you want to call it. They've sent back 19,000 people, which sounds great. And they've also said, you know, they are the people that have chartered the four biggest return flights in the whole of British history. There's never been any larger sort of mass deportations than what they have provided. And all of that sounds really good on paper. But I worked out that Labour are basically sending back 633 migrants per week, and they're just the illegals. But when you look at legal and illegal migrants together, for the last year that we have figures for, a whopping 18,463 migrants came into Britain per week. That's legal and illegal, obviously. It's both.
How many per week?
It's 17,463 legally, and then there's 1,000 per week, roughly, illegal. So it's 18,463 migrants come and settle in Britain per week.
Jeez.
And they're talking about sending 633 back. So when you just look at illegal migrants, sending back 633 is something like 0.05% of all the illegal migrants. And even if no more illegal migrants came in, even if they completely secured the border, it would take them 41 years, well, over 41 years to send them all back. And that doesn't even account for their children. So they reckon there's about 144,000 children of illegal migrants living in the UK, and whether you'd even be able to send them back under British law as it currently stands is another thing. And what I mean by that is we don't have birthright citizenship as you do. So your 14th Amendment basically is birthright citizenship. We don't have a 14th Amendment, but we basically do have a birth certificate. And if you have a British birth certificate, you can apply for a British passport. And if you have a British passport, you are effectively a citizen. So I'm not really sure how that would pan out, you know, with the 144,000. You see, this is the problem. So once you've got, so you've got a couple of illegal migrants, man and woman, they wash up on British shores. And they manage to live here for 3 years. And in that 3 years, they have two children who are both born in British hospitals, attain British birth certificates, and are then eligible to attain British passports. At that point, they are pretty much undeportable. But that makes their parents undeportable, because British legal precedent states that you cannot deport adults if it disadvantages their children who have a right to live here. So obviously, if you're two adult illegal migrants and you arrive on British shores with two children, you could be deported as a family. Whether they've ever deported families, I don't know. But you could technically be deported as a family. So that would be, you know, that would obviously be sort of a big thing if that happened. You would end up with a situation where could it happen? Probably not. They probably wouldn't deport a family. But they technically could. They probably wouldn't, but they technically could. But once the children are born on British soil, it makes it virtually impossible under British legal precedent to do that. So this video basically lays out that effectively the Labour Party isn't going to be really making a big dent in the number of illegal migrants living in Britain or the number of migrants. But and obviously there are more illegal migrants coming to Britain. Even if you take the legal ones out, there's still more illegal coming in than they're kicking out. So basically the point of the video is just to say this is nothing more than political posturing. But if you want all the facts and figures, please go and check that out. You know, I put quite a lot of effort into my weekly videos. There's a lot of research goes into them. So if you want to support me, I'm not asking for your money, but I would appreciate it if you go and gave the video a view and a like.
It's interesting that they're even posturing this way, because it shows that there's really not public support for a lot of immigration. In the United States, you know, you've had all of the diversity is our greatest strength BS for maybe the past 30 years. I think was Clinton saying this stuff? Certainly Biden was saying it's our greatest strength. But as vice president, 10, 15 years ago, Biden once made a speech where he commented on whites become a minority. And he said, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing, because diversity is our greatest strength. They've been saying this kind of stuff. You know, you also have narratives about how the immigrants do jobs Americans won't do, how important they are for the economy. Of course, if you actually, you know, break down welfare usage and other things, the immigrants, especially the illegal immigrants, but they're a burden for the economy. But you know, you can make economic arguments, but no matter what the argument is for economic argument, the question is are the people here for the economy, or is the economy here for the people? If you're replacing your people just to get economic benefits, well, then, you know, then you're saying that the people are just here for the economy, the country doesn't belong to the people. It belongs to, you know, whoever's in charge of the economy, the economic elite, which is something that a lot of Americans don't seem to understand yet. But I'll kick it back to you, Mark.
Well, this is the interesting thing. I would actually say a lot of this migration is driven by the fact that I made a video on this a long time ago, driven by the fact that the government desires constant economic growth. And although these people do suck money out of the system in the terms of, well, you know, they are a net drain on resources in terms of they claim benefits, they use the health system, their children go into sort of public education. None of this is good. In terms of sort of that balance of in out, you know, they're not taxpayers, but they are a tax drain. However, something that often gets overlooked is these people are consumers. They are people that come in and they do spend money. They consume, you know, they go to shops, they buy things, they commit in that way. And it's, I think they're keeping the figures looking good via immigration. And I've got some good facts on that. And this was something else I was thinking of doing a show on. I haven't done a show on this. I might. But recently, the house building companies, I'm not just going to say builders, but specifically house building companies, because in this country, the companies that build houses have a massive, massive influence over the government. If you look at previous Conservative governments, these companies have always gone and attended, you know, breakfast meetings and done other such things with the Prime Minister. They've had this big influence over the way the country is run. Now, that's interesting because a lot of the economy is built in this country around building these new build houses and constantly having this churn of we're building new houses, we're building new houses, we're building new houses, we need new houses, we've got to churn up this countryside to build new houses. Then people buy the houses and there's a constant increase in value of house prices because the population keeps growing, so there's scarcity. So I bought my house for £180,000, but 5 years later it's worth £200,000. Wow, I've made £20,000 by buying a house. Be a homeowner, buy a house. That's the mentality in this country. And I think the thing that I'm getting at here is this is the motor of our economy. And recently, these house building companies actually said that they want more immigration. They've come out and nakedly said, look, we need more immigrants. We need more immigrants coming in because there's such a demand for new houses that we need migrants to come in to build the houses. So it's like, well, we've got a housing shortage. Well, you could stop bringing in immigrants. No, we're bringing more immigrants to build more houses because, you know, we need immigrants. And we need immigrants because there's this cycle of building houses, buying houses, house prices rise, and it's a constant cycle that feeds into itself. Now, this is part of how Western economies work. Western economies work because they are built on this fallacy of constantly rising GDP. And one of the ways that you constantly raise GDP is to keep bringing people in. So those people force up prices, force up house prices, build equity, buy things, consume, and it makes the economy look healthy on paper. And one of the ways that the mainstream political parties have remained, one of the ways that they've remained there in power and have continued to hold such grasp over Western people is they constantly tell people in the West, look, you know, you should keep voting for us. You should keep doing this. You should keep stay on the reservation because we have kept the economy running as it should. You know, the economically things are sound. We have sound economics here in the West, and those sound economics are thanks to a policy of largely mass immigration and constant, you know, the constant GDP growth, which comes not from industrialization, not from a healthy balance of trade. It certainly doesn't come from sort of, you know, this, you know, amazing new technology that the West has. It all comes from this simple, well, we have to keep growing the population and or growing the number of consumers and workers within society. And there's been several ways they've done this at that time. So it's not all just about immigration. So if you looked at economic growth in the 60s and 70s, there was a growing population, but there was a massive growth in the economy, largely because women went from being stay-at-home mums to being workers. Now, that obviously caused huge growth in GDP because all of a sudden, you know, all these women had a much greater disposable income. It led to a greater level of consumption, etc. But you can only pull that trick once. You can only turn women from stay-at-home mums into workers once. You can't keep doing that because once it's been done, the women are all out of the home. And you've also got the problem that once the women are out of the home and once they're all at work and once they're doing the whole career thing, they do stop having as many children. And once they stop having as many children, you then end up in this position where they're not churning out the kids. So you're not getting the natural population growth from white people. Well, once you're not getting that, where are you getting the people from? Well, you've got to open those doors, haven't you? You've got to open those floodgates. You've got to bring in the migrants. And all of this plays into the idea that we need these people because if we don't, we might have a falling or stagnating population. And the only way to keep GDP growing indefinitely is to grow the population, or more importantly, to grow both the workforce and arguably to a greater degree, the number of consumers within your society.
Oh, well, that's very well put. And that's, you know, that in so many economies, in so many countries, certainly Western countries, you know, what was going on in, say, the Soviet bloc in the Cold War, it was always hard to tell even what their figures meant. But, yeah, the priority on economic growth has been huge. And when I was kind of in the environmental movement, I was trying to write papers on this. I don't know if I ever got anything published, but on the fallacy of orienting everything towards economic growth, you know, because what it does a few things, but you know, ultimately this economic growth becomes unsustainable. But our policies have all been oriented around economic growth, except for there's an interesting example of a change to this a few years back. Everything had been oriented towards that GDP number. Let's get that GDP number up. You know, maybe during World War II, it's like, well, let's orient everything towards winning the war. Well, then back in 2020, 2021, 2022, everything was oriented, everything, all policy was oriented towards getting COVID either deaths or then later case numbers down. Let's get COVID case numbers down. And so you did have this this short period of time, like the hell with the GDP. You know, the GDPs were crashing, unemployment was rising, everything was horrible. But those COVID case numbers, we don't want anybody getting sick now, do we? It was odd. And one thing I've always said is that when you orient all policy towards one set of numbers, which typically is GDP numbers, that's typically what it is. But, you know, it could be territory on the ground that your troops occupy, or, you know, it was COVID case numbers. You're just going to get a disaster. But, you know, one other thing that you're pointing out that is, I think it's really important, is that if this is your environment for a long period of time, everything is oriented towards GDP growth, you're going to have the just like in biological evolution, if you've got an environment, the organisms in that environment are going to change. They're going to change their behavior. They're going to change over generations. Their bodies are going to change to adapt to a new environment. And so if your environment is to maximize GDP, well, then you've got your economic organisms, whether they're firms, whether they're industries, and they're going to adapt to that. And, you know, you're bringing up the example of how the housing industry has just kind of adapted to the idea of just ever expanding need for housing. And, you know, if your economic players adapt to this, and that now they've got a stake in it, they've got a stake in ever growing populations. And to the extent that they've got power within the political system, then you've got this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think that's what you're getting at. And it's really important, thing to understand. So I'll kick it back to you, Mark.
Well, I think there's also an interesting point to this, like, because for a long time, people have genuinely valued economic growth. I'm not going to try and claim that they haven't. You know, there has been a huge value placed upon economic growth in the West, not just by politicians, but by normal people who had feared us not having economic growth. But I do think that is changing to a degree now, not least because obviously when you say to people, what's the most important factor in your life? Now, a lot of people are going to say, thank you.
Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Paudi Arco Super Tea comes from the only tree in the world that fungus does not grow on. As a result, it naturally has antifungal, anti-infection, antiviral, antibacterial, anti-inflammation, and anti-parasite properties. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. The tea is also organic and naturally caffeine-free. A one-pound package of tea is $49.95, which includes shipping. To order, please visit drinksupertea.com. The first word is drink, spelled D-R-I-N-K, then the word super, then the word tea. The complete website is drinksupertea.com. Or call us at 818-965-9113, Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. California time. That's 818-965-9113. DrinkSuperTea.com.
Do you begin to smell some funky little things going on? Let me share this story with you. It's not so much a story, it's something I wrote years ago. Read your history, people. Stock markets collapse on Friday. Bank seizures, closures, holidays take place after business hours on Friday. Do currencies or governments also collapse on Friday? Tomorrow's Friday. Will the end come on this Friday, or will the inevitable collapse hold off for a while? The next round of the worst financial crisis in 100 years is coming, people, and the government is out to make you and I pay for it. And will your savings survive a global banking wipeout? What happens when the U.S. sees hyperinflation? What if taxes soar not only for the rich? Can you survive if the stock market tanks? Look, between a stock market wipeout, waves of bank failures, soaring government spending that will lead to hyperinflation, and the destruction of the dollar's value, isn't it time that you prepare for the uncertainty which lies ahead? Protect your money now or forever kiss it goodbye. My friends, I offer you over 6 decades' experience of hard asset ownership and knowledge, and I'm prepared to handle the smallest detail in the balanced protection of your portfolio. For as the future of uncertainty continues to blanket this nation of ours, I believe that I can offer you the privacy, safety, security, and possibly some profitability which you deserve. And so I invite you to visit SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com for further information regarding protecting your wealth. Or call me, Jeffrey Bennett, at 602-799-8214. Or by email at KettleMoraineLTD@Cox.net for private consultation. Once again, our phone number, 602-799-8214. It's almost Friday.
But by normal people who had feared us not having economic growth. But I do think that is changing to a degree now, not least because obviously when you say to people, what's the most important factor in your life? Now, a lot of people are going to say money. There's, if you say to people, what's the most important factor in, you know, happiness and stability and what influences your family the most? I think a lot of people are straight away going to say income. So because income is seen as so important, and look, I'm not saying it's not either. I'm not saying that's a fallacy, because of course it's not. You know, when it comes down to it, you know, you do want your family to be, you know, happy, well off. You know, you want your family to have nice stuff. You don't want your family to be poor or impoverished or struggling to put food on the table. That would be a horrible position to be in. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, that's how people should live. But it does come to a point where I think a lot of people are going to say, well, okay, I do want there to be, you know, I do want there to be, you know, economic growth. I do want there to be prosperity. I do want people to have it good. But I also want to be able to, you know, drive to work in the morning and not spend 2 hours stuck in traffic. You know, I also want to, you know, I want to have money in my pocket, but when I'm not well, I don't want to be sat in a hospital waiting room for 6 hours to see a doctor when I think I'm about to have a heart attack. You know, I think there's going to be people who say, well, I do want economic prosperity, of course, but at the same time, I want my child to have a small enough class size that they get a good education. And I think when you start looking at everything that we're talking about now, there starts to be a point where people will say, well, look, I do want to have more money in my pocket, but there are other things. You get to the point where the compromises you're making in order to, you know, achieve that more money in your pocket start to look less and less rosy. And people start to look and say, well, you know, I don't really want that anymore. You know, I've given too much. We've given too much in terms of what we're meant to give. We've given up too much just for a little bit of extra cash. And I do think that is something which is we are starting to see. I think we are starting to see people, you know, say, okay, economic prosperity isn't the be all and end all. And that's been a long time coming. But I think that is sort of creeping. I think that is creeping up on us. And whether enough people are thinking like that yet, I don't know. I wouldn't like to say. I think there are still plenty of people who sadly, you know, haven't, you know, that hasn't dawned on enough people yet. But I do think it will begin to dawn on people as time goes by.
And there's, yeah, it's, well, one thing is, what I was talking about, alluding to before, is the one-dimensional priorities of policymakers. See, there's one statistic, and they want to maximize it. Usually, it's GDP. Occasionally, it's something else. And the thing is, in real life, you have multiple priorities. Yeah, you want the cash in your pocket, but you know, you also want safe streets to walk on. You know, you have other things that you want, and so it's not about maximizing one thing to get a little bit more money in your pocket if you have to face the risk of, you know, double the risk of being shot down or your daughter being raped or something like that. You're actually willing to have less money in your pocket in order to have a safer street. But, of course, in order to be completely safe, you don't want to live in poverty either. So rather than maximizing one or maximizing the other, you know, there's the idea of optimizing. You know, you try to get as much as possible the best of both worlds. And, you know, this is how real people lead their real lives. But we don't get that so much in government. You get this optimization, this maximization, and so often it's economic. Now, of course, there are other concerns out there. And the reason we have immigration isn't simply to maximize GDP. The people who run our societies have an interest in turning the white majorities into white minorities and rather maligned white minorities. So you certainly have that aspect as well. And that plays a major role. The other thing I was wanting to say is, as people are understanding that this, you know, maybe understanding the economic argument, you're getting a lot of, you also get a lot of narratives about how immigration's good for society. You know, you always talk about how, you know, they try to emphasize the importance of being able to have a good Indian curry takeaway, right? Carry home or whatever you call it.
Do you know the number of times I've actually heard sort of serious people who are meant to be serious political commentators say, you know, the big reason why we need to support, you know, continued mass immigration is effectively just that if we didn't, we might be sacrificing the curry, you know, and that would be the unthinkable position to take, you know, suggesting that the curry was no longer going to be available.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Well, hello, folks. This is Mike Gatti, the Rebel Madman at Republic Broadcasting Network. If you are searching for your inner rebel, it can be found at the Dixie Republic. It's the world's largest Confederate store, located in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. The anti-white, anti-Christ, anti-Southern world ends at the asphalt. Welcome to God's country. Log on to thedixierepublic.com to view all of their Southern merchandise, from flags to t-shirts to artwork. At the store, browse through their extensive collection of belt buckles and have a custom-made leather belt handcrafted in their Johnny Reb gun and leather shop. Now remember, dixierepublic.com, where you can meet all of your Southern needs.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Howdy, cousins. This is RBN host Blackbird 9, a.k.a. Frederick C. Blackburn, asking you to please support the Republic Broadcasting Network. Every day, RBN's mission is to use our collective voices to spread truth and relevant information, to gain a deeper understanding of the adversary, and to gain knowledge for survival against the gradual erosion of the Republic. But in order to sustain this incredible communications network, RBN needs your financial contributions. To donate, visit republicbroadcasting.org, call 1-800-724-2719, or mail your donations to 2251 Double Creek Drive, Suite 302, Round Rock, Texas, 78664. Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
We didn't. We might be sacrificing the curry, you know, and that would be the unthinkable position to take, you know, suggesting that the curry was no longer going to be available, or like the kebabs weren't going to be available anymore. That's the one kind of sacrifice, yeah, that your average Brit would not accept. And I'm not sure about that. I also think it's a really weak argument.
Mass immigration, or maybe you can just distribute some cookbooks.
Well, it is interesting you say that, but like the way I see it in terms of immigration and the sort of desire for fast food, if you want to call it a desire for fast food, you know, the need for fast food, is that essentially you don't actually need your entire country to be overwhelmed or swamped in order to eat food, do you? So you kind of, it's not really one of those situations where you need endless numbers of people. So if you look at a small sort of town in the UK, just any sort of any small town, you know, you'd expect there to be a Chinese restaurant. Now, if you want to eat Chinese food, it's there for you. You can have your Chinese. You can, you know, you can order your takeaway on an evening and sit with your wife and, you know, enjoy some tasty food. But, and this is the huge but, if you're going to enjoy your tasty Chinese meal, you don't actually need millions of Chinese people to come here, do you?
No.
You know, if every town in the UK, or if say every major city had like 10 Chinese restaurants, that would mean, you know, a Chinese family, you needed a Chinese family to operate those, you'd have about 40 Chinese people in every major city. Well, major cities have hundreds of thousands of people. It wouldn't be intrusive. But the issue with mass immigration, the issue you have, this sort of these sort of swamping numbers, is they are absolutely intrusive into our lives. And those numbers are basically far and away beyond what any normal person would say, yeah, we're comfortable with. You know, normal people simply are not comfortable with the numbers that we have at the moment. The numbers we have at the moment, they're numbers that really, other than your sort of your politicians and your state mouthpieces and media mouthpieces, no one's comfortable with those numbers. Those numbers are simply, as I said, swamping. And those swamping numbers are so vast that you can't just justify them with, oh, look at the tasty food. You know, it just simply doesn't work like that. You know, that's not how the figures, you know, work in any way. In fact, quite the opposite. The figures are so large now that any reasonable person would say that the only reason to bring these people in is your GDP, but also the issue of bringing in enough people to demographically change a country and to socially engineer that country into being something that it never previously was.
Okay, so we've been talking about this, and you know, the show is half or so over. There was also another topic that we were going to breach, and that was what's going on with negotiations aimed at ending the war in Ukraine. And it seems that President Trump, maybe by the end of the month, as early as by the end of the month, might actually be meeting with Vladimir Putin, where the delegations that would be involved in negotiating some sort of deal, the members of those teams are starting to be released. So it looks like you might get talks. Zelensky's in freakout mode. You were telling me some stuff before we started recording. So what are the latest developments here?
Well, Zelensky is in freakout mode. I hope I can bring this up on my phone because it's actually a very, very interesting article. Zelensky has said, here it is, breaking news. Zelensky says he won't accept the outcome of US-Moscow peace talks unless Ukraine is able to participate, as Lavrov says Russia will not give up any land. So, you know, this makes Zelensky look extremely disposable. Now, obviously, Zelensky has been wheeled out numerous times as the genuine 100% definite, de facto, total leader of the Ukraine that everybody loves and everyone adores and is absolutely not a Western puppet and absolutely does have genuine control. But now it's looking quite the opposite. So it's almost like when parents involve their children in making a decision, but when things turn really serious and the decision has to be, you know, locked down and the final talks are underway of how something is going to be done, the parents are like, right, well, we've involved you as much as we're going to. We've made you feel good and we've made you feel important. But can you please sit down so the big boys can talk, so to speak? And that's how it looks with Zelensky. Zelensky does not look like he's an important part of this. In fact, quite the opposite. It looks very much as if Zelensky has been sort of sidelined completely by the Trump regime. You know, Trump has clearly sort of signaled that, in fact, he's not the important part, that all he's been in all of this is essentially a puppet. And now that the puppet show is over, you know, America is going to hold discussions with Russia, and something, you know, some solution is going to be reached. But that solution is going to be reached, you know, minus the input of Zelensky. Zelensky is obviously not happy about this. You know, I didn't think he probably would be, but it is the reality of the situation, which goes to show that this is very much been, you know, as we've said many times on this show, a proxy war. It was a proxy war between the Western powers and Russia, between the sort of, you know, military industrial complex that you've seen in the US and between Russia's military industrial complex, to see, you know, which one would emerge victorious. And it seems now that it's actually pretty obvious who's emerged victorious. Russia have won. I'm not saying there hasn't been a human cost to that victory. There clearly has, and it's, you know, horrendous human cost. But nevertheless, they have emerged victorious. And on the back of that, I think now, you know, Zelensky is being treated with quite a bit of contempt. But interestingly, or the interesting thing for Brits is that essentially it looks again as if it will be British soldiers who will be securing any peace deal, as Starmer has taken to the press this morning to release a statement. And his statement is actually quite worrying. He said it's time for us to step up. By us, he doesn't mean him. It doesn't mean him, his children, his family. It means everybody else under his command, because he's the prime minister. But he says this is the moment for us all to step up. Keir Starmer says it's time to put boots on the ground in Ukraine and send British troops in to enforce a peace deal. So it's almost as if this sort of peace deal has been 100%, you know, ratified in all but, you know, it's almost like it's been worked out. The ink hasn't been put on the paper, but the deal does look to have already been done, despite the ink not actually being on the paper yet. The deal does look as if it has been done. And it's quite interesting because obviously, you know, with this all happening and the way it has been, it appears that Britain has been given its role in the peace deal, which is, you know, to go in as a peacekeeping force, which will be very interesting from a British point of view, because Britain, as a peacekeeping force, will be there to stop potentially the flare up of any other hostilities, which I think is interesting, because I don't believe there's going to be a flare up of hostilities from the Russian side. I think if there's going to be a flare up of any hostilities, that flare up will be the hostilities from the Ukrainian side. I think it'll be the Ukrainian side that is more likely to carry on or wish to carry on hostilities, and that may be from the top all the way down. So I do think this is going to be a very, very interesting time, and I do think this is panning out in a way that isn't good for Britain, but it is good in the sense that the war will come to an end. But this is very much, I think, a big win for Donald Trump. I think this is a huge win for Donald Trump, because he's bringing this to a close swiftly. I think this will be an end to you know, American tax dollars being wasted over there, which I think Americans will be extremely happy about. I think this is something that will annoy those within the deep state who pursued this conflict. But I personally don't see any of these, other than British troops being on the ground, which is an absolute disaster, I don't see this as a bad thing. I think an end to the loss of life over there is something that people like myself and you have wanted from the very beginning. So do you see any negatives to all this? And do you see the prospect of lasting peace when there are a number of different groups, you know, that have fallen under Ukrainian control during this conflict, which do operate to some degree with autonomy outside of central command? Do you think those groups would be likely to break the peace agreements and attempt to continue this after the fact?
So, yeah, if anything is going to continue after a peace agreement is reached between the primary people we're talking about here, it's going to be either these, you know, Azov battalion style anti-Russian elements that have been notorious in Ukraine, not just during this military conflict, but also during the 2014 coup, during the in-between years where there was this massive shelling of Donetsk and Lugansk that killed some 14,000 of the residents of these breakaway republics. So you had that, and then the other worry is not so much under a Trump administration, but perhaps under a future administration, or under the CIA, if Trump doesn't manage to gain control over the so-called deep state, which he never got control over last time, you know, you could have CIA or other deep state, so-called deep state backed elements, which would likely be the Azov battalion types, but conceivably could be something else. To the extent that they're post ceasefire, post settlement, that there could be continued, say, guerrilla warfare or something, that's where it would come from. Regarding Ukraine, I think, people tend to look at a map and project that map backwards. And there is a particular shape that Ukraine had during our lifetimes. And, people kind of tend to assume, okay, well, there's been a Ukraine. The Ukraine's been around for a long time. Actually, Ukraine as its own independent entity has virtually no history. In the 20th century, in the middle of World War II, there was a Ukrainian puppet state that was allied with Germany. In the aftermath of World War I, there was a Ukrainian puppet state that then was absorbed into the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. These were both very short-lived and weren't really genuinely independent entities. And the shape of their maps was very different from the shape of post-Soviet independent Ukraine. I did an exercise yesterday where I looked at Ukraine's five biggest cities and just the history of who was ruling them over the past several centuries. And if you look, you look at, for instance, Volk, which is the fourth largest city in Ukraine. It's also ranked Lviv on more modern maps. And it's in the far west of Ukraine. And it's almost never, it's rarely been in the same political entity as Odessa or as Kharkov. Kharkov, also written Kharkiv, in the east. Lvov and Kharkiv have rarely been in the same political entity. They've rarely been in the same country historically. Lviv, over by the Polish border, as before the 20th century, before actually not the 20th century, but before World War II, had almost never been ruled from Moscow. It had been ruled from Poland or Lithuania or the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but it had never really been ruled from Moscow. And the people of that region, Galicia, and I guess there's some neighboring regions, don't really have that much of a history with Russia. And Putin doesn't have any desire to force these people to live under them. They were only living under Moscow in the aftermath of World War II as part of the Soviet Union. And demographically, the Soviet Union had plenty of problems. And it's not as if Putin doesn't want to recreate the Soviet Union with its various demographic problems. But there's a Kharkov to the extent, if you look at it, history over the centuries, it has been part of the same entity that the Russian Empire, the Russian state, and so they have very, very different histories. And so you can basically divide Ukraine into three regions. One, regions that the Russian government definitely wants to control. They're full of Russians. They have long history with Russia. Then another region in the far west that historically does not have much connection with Russia and that are the home to these more problematic elements that you're talking about that they don't want them. And then in between, areas that could go either way, that they has a certain connection, would have a certain value to Russia, but aren't absolutely necessary. So there certainly are going to be regions in what's now Ukraine that Russia doesn't want. And then, so there is a question, then who takes care of them? Who is going to, Russia really does not want to have its own troops patrolling Lviv or Lvov and doesn't want that. So, you know, do you have a situation where you've got Scott, what was the guy's, Pete Hegseth, he's talked about European troops or non-European troops. You know, does that mean Chinese? Does that mean Indian? Does that mean from Fiji? But he's talked about that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. And the last thing I want to say is Trump has repeatedly said things like he could end the war very promptly in 24 hours, even before he's inaugurated. But he's also consistently said that this would have never happened had he been president. Now, he's only been president.
February is Heart Month. Every year for the month of February, to show our appreciation to Extendivite's faithful customers, we have a sale. If you would like to try Extendivite, now is the time to get a few months ahead and really give Extendivite the time to show you how it works. Most of Extendivite's long-term customers wait for this sale to stock up. People and doctors tell us about the unbelievable improvements that they have experienced in their overall health, not just the heart. Extendivite wants you to experience the power of these herbs. Get a 4-month supply for only $115 for either the capsules or tincture. Please take advantage of this once per year sale and get healthy for life. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or find us on Amazon.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Are you sick of censorship? TLB Talk is the cure. TLB stands for Truth, Liberty, and Balance. We are the newest and most unique social media platform to hit the internet. We were built out of necessity because Big Tech, Big Pharma, and Big Brother are out of control. The only thing bigger than them is when we, the people, are united. With that vision, TLB Talk was born. Our battlefield is in cyberspace. The battle we're in can be won by clicks of buttons and voting with your wallet. TLB Talk has no hidden agendas, no corporate funding, and we do not sell, trade, or give away any of your information. Our platform runs off of generous donations of members and merchandise profits. So please, check out our site. It's the best around. And be sure to stop by our store. It's loaded with items that'll have you feeling a sense of member pride and victory. Come unite with us today at tlbtalk.com and join the social media revolution.
Hi, Tom Bolton for Ease Off. I know so many of you are finding our EZ4 carcass drop and lift an essential tool for your meat processing operation, but today I want to spotlight four of our new products. First, our right height hog cradles with steel or aluminum frames. Our customers love this back-saving innovation that enhances sanitation and speeds production. Next, our beef cradles with stainless steel or aluminum frames eliminate rust and corrosion. We hope you'll compare our quality and prices for this essential part of your processing line. Our cradles are especially effective when used with our power skinner. And finally, our hook tumbler will keep your hooks clean and polished. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
EaseOff, LLC, 417-932-6419.
Has repeatedly said things like he could end the war very promptly in 24 hours, even before he's inaugurated. But he's also consistently said that this would have never happened had he been president. Now, he's only been president less than a month at this point. And at this point, you can still say he doesn't have ownership in the war. He's not invested in the war. And so he can walk away from it. And to the extent it's seen as a loss, it's not his loss. He won't be able to do that much longer. Right. If he starts if he starts sending off shipments of weaponry and money, cash to Ukraine, then he gets ownership of it. And then a settlement is more and more going to be seen as a loss for him. So this really has to happen pretty quick. I think Trump, one way or another, walk away from this. If he can walk away from it where there's some sort of settlement, it's probably better for him politically. But he's at the point where he either needs to walk away from it and wash his hands of Ukraine, or he's going to be linked to it. He's going to have some sort of ownership of it. And of course, the longer the fighting goes on, the more territory Russia acquires, the more blood gets shed almost entirely on the Ukrainian side. So those are my thoughts and comments. I'll kick it back to you before we wrap up the show.
Well, I think when Trump came to power the first time, people wanted a president that was not invested in more endless wars. I think that's fair to say. And Trump did categorize himself as the president that didn't want wars. He wanted to be out of Iraq. He wanted to be out of Afghanistan. He didn't want American troops patrolling the world who were sort of at risk of, you know, coming home either in body bags or, you know, injured. And he didn't want huge amounts of American spending on these huge sort of military operations, which, you know, let's be fair, average American people do not see those military engagements as a benefit to their life. It's not something that benefits their life. If anything, it's something that makes their life much worse off, because they're paying for things and they're seeing potentially, you know, family members, loved ones, etc., coming back from these places, either dead, or, you know, either in body bags or, you know, in a way that they can't live a full life, a full and healthy life afterwards. So I would say this is something that people would want to see. And the fact that we're still less than a month in from Trump being inaugurated, I would say this is also decisive action. This is something that Trump has been very decisive over. And I think that's a good thing. I think we're seeing a decisive Trump, a Trump that is taking action, and taking action on big, big issues. And if he brings this war to a close and it does end the wholesale slaughter in eastern Ukraine, I think that's got to be something that goes in his favor. And people say, well, look, you know, this man did deliver on some of the big issues that he wanted to, you know, he wanted to deliver, he promised. And that was something that was really lacking in the first Trump administration.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for joining me, Mark.
Thank you for having me on.
And I'll be back again tomorrow with a very special episode of National Bugle Radio. We will be talking about the Trump assassination attempt with an eyewitness, a very close eyewitness to the attempt. So that's for tomorrow, and I'll be back again then. Bye-bye.
Hey there, this is Sheila with Hempaste by Mynutra. Why is hempaste better than other CBD options on the market? It's important to point out that the common CBD oil does not contain CBDA or CBGA, and they're only found in fresh or raw hemp products, like hempaste. Hempaste contains the entire plant, minus any stems. This means the product retains the complete genetic code of the plant, which also includes those two vital cannabinoids, CBGA and CBDA. Over and over, experts keep saying the more intact or less processed the hemp plant is, the more effective it is. Happy hemp paste.
Hemppaste.com/RBN. Free shipping on orders over $50. See the banners for hemp paste at republicbroadcasting.org. And visit hemppaste.com/RBN.
Call 855-656-8872. Mention RBN.
You can't handle the truth!
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit republicbroadcasting.org today, because you